It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at. Like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-334-KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.
Today's show is sponsored by Howl FM. It's like Netflix for podcasts. With Howl Premium, you'll get exclusive access to dozens of original Howl miniseries, like The Mysterious Secrets of Uncle Bertie's Botanarium, a richly sound-designed adventure comedy starring Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords. Access it all on your iPhone, your Android phone, or on the web for only $4.99 a month. And if you use the promo code MALTIN at checkout, you'll get a full month for free. That's M-A-L-T-I-N, and you'll get a full month free of charge. Check it out. Howl.fm. Hello, everybody. It's Leonard Maltin. This is Maltin on Movies. And my guest today is Jeff Nichols. And if you don't know that name yet, shame on you, because you should. Because you should have seen Take Shelter and Mud and even his first film, Shotgun Stories. They all, incidentally and not so incidentally, star Michael Shannon, who is featured more prominently than ever in his latest film, Midnight Special, which has just opened in a handful of cities and will go wider on April 1st. And I have just recently come back from Austin, Texas, which is Jeff's place of residence. And it debuted there at the South by Southwest Film Festival to great acclaim. And I'm very happy to welcome him here today. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's fun to see you again. You were very kind to come to my class at USC with your last film, Mud, which I loved. And this film is just such an experience.
Thank you.
Now, there's so many things I want to ask you about, not just this film, but we'll talk about all sorts of things. But since we've just come, both of us, from South by Southwest, was that the first time you saw it with a large audience?
No, we had premiered it a month before that in Berlin.
Ah.
But you couldn't talk about two, different audiences. I really liked the idea of going to Berlin as kind of the first true public premiere mm-hmm. of the film, simply because, it's a sci-fi chase movie. Mm-hmm. That could be pretty easily written off or dismissed. And I think it's a pretty thoughtful, pretty soulful sci-fi chase movie. So I liked the idea of going to kind of a prestigious International Film Festival and putting that kind of frame around it for the very first screening. That said, I was really looking forward to South By because mm-hmm. that's where we had one of our best screenings of Mud. Obviously, it's my hometown now. I didn't grow up there, but it's where I live now. And it just seems like a place where fans of movies go to watch films.
And
I wanted to see how this movie landed with those types of people.
And how did it?
From my perspective, it was really good. It's a strange movie. There's not a lot of laughter in it. Mm-hmm. So much like Take Shelter, you can be three quarters of the way through the film and you're not sure if people are bored or if mm-hmm. they're with you or not. Mm-hmm. But then luckily, Adam Driver's character shows up. He cracks a couple jokes and you hear people laughing and you say, okay, they're still here. They're still paying attention. So I think it felt good when it was all said and done.
It's because that was my follow-up, is that when you don't have a comedy and you don't have obvious triggers –
right.
For audience response, how do you gauge an audience? And you've sort of already said it's hard to do.
It is, You get a sense. Of course, I'm a total narcissist like all other filmmakers. So every person that coughs or gets up to use the restroom, you're like, okay, are they coming back? When are they leaving? And there were a few instances at the South By screening where I saw people get up to use the bathroom and they literally ran out and ran back in. So that made me feel really good. Although I couldn't help but think, wow, they just missed this one scene. And there's not a lot of information in my film to begin with. And if you take one thing out, it's going to be interesting to see if that person likes the movie.
Well, we're all sensitive to these things. And artists, obviously, more sensitive than anyone else. And in fact, this is terrible. I'm going to name drop. There it is. Jerry Lewis just turned 90 last week. And one of the first times I got to talk to him was after a lecture he'd given at the Academy. to a packed house, you know, in their theater with seats about 1,000 people. Hmm. And in the course of just talking about it, he said, you were there that night. I said, yes. He said, you know, it's always interesting. He says, and, you know, and some people, you know, are very attentive, and some people leave or walk out, and that always hurts. Mm-hmm. And there he was, Jerry Lewis, you know,
Jerry Lewis,
feeling the hurt, the pain of someone walking out.
Yeah.
Not that 997 people stayed.
Of course.
Right, but the two people walked out.
Probably the most awkward moment in all this press stuff is when they take you to a theater to do a Q&A. You haven't sat through the film, obviously, and they're ushering you up front to start this Q&A, and you just have to apologize as you squeeze past all these people leaving. And you hope they're just going to the bathroom, but you're pretty sure they're just going to their car. It's a humbling experience. I think it's good.
I'm sure.
It's good to mix.
It builds
mix
character,
in.
As we say.
It does.
Well, what's funny is at my class – filmmakers often say, gee, everybody stayed. Right. I said, we collect their IDs at the beginning of the class. They can't leave. I just can't lie to them.
Right.
You know, I feel it would be, you know, it'd be improper to lie
true.
To them.
It's true.
So I kind of have to burst their bubble just a little bit, just a little bit. But they do stay, and most of them are attentive, so that's a good thing.
Absolutely. They were when I was there.
What kind of question? No. We don't want to give away anything. It's a ground rules here in discussing Midnight Special, because it's a film with considerable mystery,
right,
and surprise in it. But what kind of things are people asking you in a general way? What kind of things are people probing to try to get answers?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. This isn't my first, you know, foray into ambiguity. Mm-hmm. With Take Shelter, it's something that I did. And I think since that was only my second film to make, I don't think I fully understood the power of leaving things open to the audience's imagination. And it wasn't until that film premiered at Sundance and you start looking online and you see message boards and people – you know, is he crazy? No, he's not crazy. No, it's real. It's not real. Mm-hmm. What a beautiful conversation to see take place. And what a shame it would have been in that first Sundance Q&A had I just said, oh, well, no, this is what it is. Mm-hmm. That would have just – it would have killed that conversation.
Sure.
And so this – you know, with Midnight Special, this is definitely a more calculated attempt at that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes too much, you know. I'm willing to accept the criticism that maybe I've pushed, you know, ambiguity into purposefully being vague. Mm-hmm. I have my position. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think the trick with this film is it's much like if you read Faulkner, for instance, not to get too heady, mm-hmm. but if you're reading Faulkner, I could sit here and tell you what happens in a Faulkner story, and it wouldn't necessarily be that great. But the way that Faulkner tells his stories, the language that he chooses to use, the structure that he chooses to lay these stories out in, that's what makes them so fascinating. And I wanted to try my hand at that, you know, a film that from beginning to end, not just the ending, but from beginning to end lays out in such a way that the experience of watching the movie, the experience of receiving the information at these very specific moments affects the story that you're being told. You know, on the surface, it's just a sci-fi chase movie, you know, guy with his son.
Well, let's just fill people in who don't know about the film or may not have read about the film yet. And my advice is read as little as you can. In fact, read nothing. I would actually advise. Go in clean slate, tabula rasa, and just experience it. But if you must know, the log line kind of synopsis is that there is a boy. He's supposed to be 8, I think.
Yes.
An 8-year-old boy played by Jaden Lieberher, who's been doing impressive work, just incredible work.
Sure.
You may have seen him in St. Vincent with Bill Murray. And he's in a wonderful little film called The Confirmation.
Which I haven't seen yet, but I'm excited.
It's quite good.
Good.
And he's awfully good in it. Anyway, this young boy has powers. That's given away pretty early on. He has some sort of strange powers. And because he has these powers, everybody wants a piece of him and everybody wants to kind of own him or maybe even abduct him or in some way use him. Or channel him for their own purposes. That includes the government, that includes a kind of a cult church in Texas. But his father, played by Michael Shannon, and Michael Shannon's longtime buddy, played by Joel Edgerton, they want to protect him.
Yes.
They want to protect him more than anything. His father will do anything to protect his son. And they set off on a chase. Well, they're being pursued is what it is. They're being pursued. And they know they're being pursued, so they're going on the lam, mostly at night, desperately trying to get to some destination which they don't really know much about.
Right.
Have I given away too much?
I think that's pretty much good. I think that's
kind
totally
of a setup
fair.
There. Yeah. Kind of the springboard. And so, as you say, a sci-fi chase movie, not a mashup one hears about too often.
Right. Right.
I don't remember chases in Forbidden Planet, for instance. But that's just me.
It's a subgenre unto itself, actually. The sci-fi government chase movie is a subgenre unto itself.
That's true. Even in The Day the Earth Stood Still, the original.
Yeah.
It's not much of a chase, but yes, they're on the prowl for Klaatu.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Wow. Anyway, I'm so impressed with this film because it pulled me in and held me and raised questions, of course, and just held me in its grip at every step, at every stage. But so much of it depends on blind faith.
Right.
And on giving you the license as storyteller to take us on this journey, even though we may not understand much of what is happening scene to scene.
Right.
But – do you – I'm not asking you to explain. I'm not doing that.
Right.
Do you understand what's happening scene to scene, or did you outline it in such a way that you had full or complete understanding?
I'm going to answer that two ways.
Mm-hmm.
On the first hand, yes, absolutely. You know, I meticulously outline these scripts. In fact, when I sit down to a computer to start to write into Final Draft, my screenwriting program, that's the last step. You know, at that point in my office, I have a giant cork board with mm-hmm. note cards that go through every scene, every transition, not every line, obviously, but every integral line in these scenes. I know exactly, shot for shot almost, what this thing's going to be. I've built a massive amount of character backstory. I've built thematic strains that go through the film that are the key thematic strains, sub-thematic strains. I've got all of that worked out. Now, that being said, this movie is about parenthood. It was really an examination of my point of view of parenthood in my first year as a parent. And kind of the epiphany there was that as a parent, number one, you have no control over your children. You have no control over their safety, over whether or not they live or die. You have no control over who they become. And you realize that as a parent, you have to have this blind faith in the potential of your child. You hope that they will be good children. You hope that they will grow up to be good people. But you really don't know. And the scary thing is you really have no control. Now, there's fear that comes from that. There's love that comes from that. And all of the feelings around it play into Mike Shannon's character in this film. So when you ask, do I know what's going on? Yes, on in the day-to-day, you know, scene-to-scene moments, absolutely. But does a parent know what's going on with their child? Do they know who they're going to be? Absolutely not. When Mike Shannon first read this script, he called me and said, you got to tell me, why are we trying to get to this place? And I said, I don't know. And you don't either. And that's the point.
Very interesting. Now, it's not telling tales out of school because I read it in the press notes, but you went through a very, very difficult and scary experience with your son.
Yes. You know, my wife and I refer to the first year of parenthood as the darkness. It's this period of time where you're just going through this sea change as a human.
Mm-hmm.
You're the pragmatic stuff, you know, there's lack of sleep, you're not eating well, your social life is completely upended, your whole life is turned on its head. And it's very easy, I think, as a parent to focus on all that extraneous stuff because you're just trying to get through every day of this new paradigm. And about 8 months in, my son had something called a febrile seizure, which is the body's reaction to a spike in fever. It happens in about 1 in 1,000 kids. It doesn't have long-lasting effects, but we didn't know that. No one told us that. And we freaked out. My son started to convulse. He turned gray.
Oh, geez.
And, it was one of those situations where we grabbed him and threw him in the car and ran through red lights and ran through the emergency room yelling, "My child can't breathe. My baby can't breathe." And it was kind of like plunging my head in a cold bucket of water. I woke up to the reality that, okay, this isn't just about my day-to-day life changing. There is this little person in front of me that is very susceptible to harm. And I was paralyzed by that idea. I was paralyzed by the fact that if this boy is walking around in the world and gets hit by a car, I will be devastated and I have no control over it. I have no say-so in the matter. So it does make you start to want to figure out how to process that. I mean, we have to put one foot in front of the other. We have to operate as parents because the kid's still there. You can't just wallow in your own, you know, potential grief. You have to do something about it. And the answer is what became kind of the heart of this movie.
Wow. And you also said in those notes, forgive me for quoting things back.
No problem. That's fine.
That it was anxiety over fatherhood that helped inspire Take Shelter.
Yeah, you know, Take Shelter was written when I had just gotten married. We were thinking about having a child. When I was shooting Take Shelter, in fact, my wife was 8 going on 9 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. When I got home from production on that, 2 weeks later, he was born. Mm-hmm. My first editing setup was in his nursery because my wife told me I wasn't allowed to leave the house for 2 weeks after he was born. And so that film was written, though, by a young man in his 20s who was coming out of, you know, post-college life and becoming an adult. And I was terrified about the concept of marriage. Would I be a good husband? Would I be in a marriage that works? What makes a marriage work? Am I going to be able to support my family? And not just as a man and some machismo thing, but like, you know, can I take care of these people? Because it's going to be my job to do that. Meanwhile, I'm writing it when the economy's collapsing, the environment's going haywire. Is the world going to be there, you know, when we show up? Is it still going to be put together in the same way? And again, it's a paralyzing type of fear. The funny thing, though, about fear is it's not a thought. Fear is a catalyst that drives a thought. And so each of these films that I've made, even Shotgun Stories, was about the fear of one of my brothers dying, you know. Each of these films begins from a place of fear. But it's my job as a storyteller to take that a step further and say, well, what thought are we going to have of that? You know, I love A Beautiful Mind, that Ron Howard film. Mm-hmm. I love that that character was constantly searching for an original thought. Now, I'm not smart enough to have an original thought, but I can at least force myself to have a complete thought, mm-hmm. which it's surprising how few people have those. When you watch pundits talk and everybody else, they're spouting things, but they rarely have a cohesive thought. And I think what I've tried to do through these films is take something like fear, take all of these anxieties that the world presents to me, and extrapolate a thought. And in this case, it was, as a parent, if I don't have any control, why am I here? And I think my job as a parent is to try and define who my son is, not project my point of view on him, not try and make him into something I want him to be, understand who he is. And as he grows, constantly revisit that definition, redefine it, and help him understand it and help him achieve that. And that's really all Mike Shannon's doing through this whole film. It's all Kirsten Dunst's doing through this whole film.
She plays his mother.
She plays the mother. Mm-hmm. Is they're just trying to do what's best for the kid. And it's amazing as parents how often we fail at that job.
Mm-hmm. I take the fifth. Well, our listeners have heard my daughter with me. My daughter's now 29. is a frequent collaborator on this show, so yes. They can make their own judgments there as to whether I've succeeded or failed miserably. I'll say no more than that.
Yeah.
And with that, we'll take a little break, and we'll be right back on Malton on Movies with my guest, Jeff Nichols. Our sponsor today, and we're grateful to them, Casper Mattresses, obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. And now you can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/Malton using the promo code Malton. That's my name, M-A-L-T-I-N. Listen, you spend about a third of your life sleeping. Sometimes I feel like it's more than that. Let's make sure you're doing it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and brighter days, namely latex foam and memory foam. So they've got just the right sink, just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. And they have a risk-free trial and return policy. I've never heard of anything like this. They'll deliver it straight to you, and you can try it out for 100 days or nights. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it up. They'll take it back. At the store, you may get a minute or two to try out a mattress. With Casper, you'll actually get to sleep on it. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress. Compare that to industry averages, and you see that it's an outstanding price point. So get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/Malton and using that promo code M-A-L-T-I-N. Terms and conditions apply. Welcome back to Malton on Movies. I am Leonard Malton, and my guest today is filmmaker Jeff Nichols, who has just written and directed a terrific film called Midnight Special, which I encourage you to go and see, and to see in a theater, on a theater screen in particular.
Please do.
Well, you know, and that is something that's harder to get people to do than ever before because there are all these options now.
Right.
And people have – well, it's practically an invitation to stay home, isn't it? With the ready or imminent availability of all these movies. But I have
a soapbox about that I can get on, but that might be a tangent you don't want to take me down.
Well, I can get you on another soapbox too. You shot this on film.
I did. I've shot all my films on film, which puts me in a minority, I think, of a lot of contemporary filmmakers. And I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky to have a crew that can manage that, you know. We just grew up doing it that way. And it's, you know.
You did go to film school.
I did go to film school. I went to North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. And, you know, we were taught on 16. My cinematographer, Adam Stone, has shot all of my films. My gaffer, Michael Roy, has been my gaffer since Take Shelter. My first assistant, cameraman Dave Reagan, who's been pulling focus with us since Take Shelter. He's younger than I am. He's a prodigy. You know, same thing with – we've had the same second AC, the same loader. This is a – it's a film group that gets together to make these things. And these guys are very, very good at their job.
Yeah. But so that people understand what we're discussing, you don't have to be a techie to get into this too deeply, but – most films now are shot digitally.
Yes.
No film passes through a camera or through a projector subsequently when it's screened. And there are still some holdouts. You're one of them. Quentin Tarantino, famously one of them.
Yes.
Christopher Nolan, a handful of others.
And now the Star Wars films they've shot on film. So J.J. Abrams did that, I think Rian Johnson's shooting his Star Wars film on film, I'm told.
And there are a lot of filmmakers, directors, and cinematographers who believe that there is a quality, a tangible quality to film that can't be replicated digitally. And what I find kind of grimly amusing is how many filmmakers I interview who talk about using old lenses in order to sort of replicate the look of film.
Right.
Though they're shooting digitally, which is the greatest irony of all.
It works, actually.
It does. And, you know, to their credit, you know.
Well, it's you know, for me, there are a few factors. Related specifically to Midnight Special, you know, this is a film inspired by sci-fi films from the 80s. So it made
sense.
Such as E.T., Close Encounters, Starman. It made sense when we did a film test. You know, we did a film versus digital test. And, you know, the Arri Alexa digital camera makes beautiful images. we were doing tests of actually the light effect, which emits from this boy's eyes. This is his power that we mentioned earlier. We did that practically. We did that in camera. We built this rig that went on the boy's face, and the light really interacted with our lenses. And when we did a test on digital, the lens flares were so crisp. They were so sharp. They were beautiful in their own right, but they didn't look like the ones I had seen growing up. Mm-hmm. They weren't organic enough.
Yeah.
And for a film that, you know, or for a film style whose aesthetic starts in grounding things in reality in terms of the cars people drive, the clothes they wear, the way the sets are built, it seemed like film is a natural extension of that aesthetic. You know, you also encounter the issue that, yes, I think film replicates the human experience the best. I think films are all fake. Everything we do in a movie is fake. And you have to suspend your disbelief for a period of time when you walk into a theater. And I think film helps you do that better than digital. I think digital has so much information. There's so many sharp corners on those zeros and ones that it somehow separates you from the image in certain instances.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to be completely fair, our entire movie is not shot on film. There was one instance when we said, okay, these scenes will be shot on a digital camera. And that's anytime you're in a moving car at night. And that's because if what we're saying is film represents the human experience better than any other format, that is absolutely true, except in a moving car at night. The problem is I want to be shooting out on a real highway or an interstate or a road. And naturally, the way our eyes work when we're in a car is there is some relationship to the foreground people in the car and the background. You can hold both and not be, you know, downtown in a really bright lit city.
Mm-hmm.
Well, film betrays itself in that instance because there's no way we would have enough lights to come in and light to get an exposure for your background. Mm-hmm. That or we'd have to shoot everything at dusk. And that's kind of dishonest too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't look like night either. So we made this one rule. If you're in a moving car at night, that all became Alexa. And I think it separates me maybe from some of those other filmmakers you mentioned. It's not film because I'm attached to an experience as a child going in to see a movie. That's not just it. Certainly that's part of it, but that's not just it. It's not nostalgia. It's that I'm trying to look for an honest format. I'm trying to look for a format that represents the way our eyes work. You know, even when you talk about the way the camera moves, it's why I don't use much handheld camera movement as a directorial feature in my films. It's because I don't think it represents the way our heads work. You know, our heads are on a natural gyroscopic swivel. So Steadicam is a lot more appropriate to that movement if used appropriately.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very interesting to me, all of this, because most people – you know, quite rightly, don't pay attention, nor should they.
Yeah, they're not supposed to. Not their job.
You're supposed to be involved in the film. That's all. Get hooked by the story, the characters. You know,
it all feeds into story. It better.
Yeah. But I do find this ongoing debate very, very interesting.
Sure.
Let's talk a little about Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
When did you first meet him? How did you first meet him? And how did your collaboration begin?
Well, I first met him in person 2 weeks before we started filming Shotgun Stories. I went to the airport to pick him up, and that was the beginning. But really, when I was first introduced to him was a professor of mine named Gary Hawkins, who was at the School of the Arts. He had been at the Sundance Labs, and you know, they workshop scripts there and they videotape scenes. And he had come back to school with a videotape of one of his scenes, and he was kind of showing me what he had done. Well, Mike Shannon had acted in one of those scenes. And when I heard that voice and when I saw his face, I just said, that's it. Whoever that is who I want to write movies for the rest of my life. And when I sat down to write Shotgun Stories, I closed my eyes and imagined him. And when it came time to cast, I called my friend, this professor, and he gave me Mike's cell phone number. And I said, Mike, I'm a kid from Arkansas. You don't know me, but I wrote a script for you. Will you please read it? And fortunately, he saw something in that script. Because it wasn't me, because he didn't know me. So it had nothing to do with my chops as a director. He just saw something in the part. And that speaks a lot, I think, to Mike Shannon, that if he sees something in a role, he'll go do it. He'll show up in the middle of nowhere in Arkansas with a bunch of people that definitively don't know what they're doing, and try and bring life to a part that he sees something in.
Well, he sure does every time.
Yeah.
Every time at bat. I've only seen him on stage once, and that was in Grace, a play I liked very much.
I saw that, yes.
And with Paul Rudd and Ed Asner. And, of course, he was terrific. No surprise there, but I hadn't had that experience of seeing him on stage.
I saw him in a one-man play called Mistakes Were Made. I wish you could have seen it. He's the only one on stage for a little over an hour, and he plays an aging Broadway producer on the phone the whole time, trying to keep this Broadway show together.
Oh, wow.
It's incredible.
That sounds great.
He's funny. He's sad. He's all these different emotions at the end of it. I wish everybody could see that play. But
here in Midnight Special, he reveals a tenderness that I don't think we've seen quite before. He's a husband and parent in Take Shelter as well,
right.
A fairly normal guy, yes. Except for external things that happen.
Of course.
But that's developed – I think it's taken to another level, yes. Here in Midnight Special. And people who find him forbidding, mm-hmm. as he often is cast to be,
yes.
in movies are in for, I think, a very pleasant surprise.
I hope so. You know, I write these lead characters kind of from my own point of view, obviously. Mm-hmm. I've already talked about the emotional inspirations. And for whatever reason, I guess when I close my eyes and imagine myself, I see Mike Shannon. but knowing Mike and having known him really since 2004 when we did Shotgun Stories, I consider him kind of like a raw nerve, mm-hmm. you know. He's extraordinarily sensitive to the world around him.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes the reaction to that is a callus, you know, and people just see the callus over mm-hmm. the fingertip.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not who he is. He has an extreme ability to tap into the way he feels about things, and that kind of seeps out through his pores. And, you know, for a writer like me, it's an extraordinary gift because I'm on my own personal, you know, mission to remove narrative exposition and remove dialogue whenever possible and try and have behavior represent real behavior as much as I possibly can. And these are Southern men who don't wear their hearts on their sleeves and don't communicate maybe as well as they should, but they're filled with all these emotions. And that's the way I feel about Mike. And so I know as a writer, I can leave out this word or that sentence or that monologue or that piece of backstory. And I know that he's going to carry it for me onto mm-hmm. the screen.
And it's going to show on his face.
It will. It'll come out of his pores.
And in his body language too.
And in his shoulders and his countenance, mm-hmm. everything. He'll carry that with him. You know, I remember in Shotgun Stories, and when you see Mike kind of walk, he kind of walks with a loping gait. And he kind of walked that way on Shotgun Stories. And that's just the way Mike walks, right? That's just what I thought. And we talked about separating his character in Shotgun Stories, a blue-collar guy, from his character in Take Shelter. Another blue-collar guy, but different. Different education levels, different socioeconomic levels. And I saw Mike move in that film, and there was no more lope, you know? There was no more kind of stuttered gait. And that's when you realize, holy crap, he has complete control over what he's doing
mm-hmm.
with his voice and with his body and with his movement. He's thinking about all these things. Now, we don't sit around and talk about that. I didn't say, hey, can you tighten it up a little bit on the movement, you know? Maybe the closest we came to it was like, I think you'll have your shirt tucked in. but he's doing the work, you know. We don't talk about it a lot, but he does it.
Tell me about directing Jaden. I'm sure that it's always a challenge of a different sort to work with a child actor, especially one who's this young and who carries so much of the burden of the story. And also you have restricted hours working with a child, and that's just a physical, mundane but physical
It affects your days. It's mm-hmm. You end up designing your shots around it sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's a real thing. You know, you can't talk about working with kids without talking about casting them mm-hmm. Because you're not going to just excuse me, you're not going to just manipulate them. I think that's a losing game. So you're trying to find a child that represents who this character is, so that hopefully they can show up and be as close to themselves as possible in this part. Now, for these two boys in Mud, I definitively did not want child actors. You know, Ty Sheridan had been in Malick's film, The Tree of Life, mm-hmm. but that's different. You know, they didn't even give him a script, you know. It was really about being in the moment. Mm-hmm. And so that was great because he had kind of been around the artifice of the filmmaking process without being crippled by it. Now, I was very afraid when I heard about Jaden and heard about him being in these other films that he would be a child actor. He would be someone that was calculated and ready to please. And that's not what I'm looking for. You know, I'm looking for somebody who can pull this off honestly, just like the adult actors. And when I met him, because we had done the casting search and gone through the Southeast and seen 1,000 kids, but because of the age range that I was picking, I couldn't use a normal 8-year-old. It didn't make sense, but mostly because Alton in the film is not a normal 8-year-old. Mm-hmm. What I needed, there is a point in this film where Alton's character becomes aware of his place in the universe. And that's a tricky thing because it's also, like we were talking about Mike, it's not about lines. It's just the way he looks at you. Mm-hmm. You know he knows the score. And when I met Jaden, he came in, and within about 5 or 10 minutes of talking, he just knew the score. He knew what was going on. He wasn't trying to please me. He just was very smart, and he was aware. So I knew in the front half of this film I could mute that. I could put his nose in a comic book, take away lines from him, and mute what was so special about him as a real person, knowing that at some point we're going to flip a switch and he's going to become aware.
Boy. Well, you chose well.
Thank you.
You certainly chose well.
It's his credit, you know. Once you do that, once you make the right selection, it's – honestly, they're easier than the adults. They're so matter of fact, you know. Mm-hmm. And Mike, I think Mike tries to act this way, you know. He doesn't always achieve it, but they're so matter of fact. It's like, where do I stand? Okay, I just read the scene. Okay, here I am. They're just in the moment, which is, you know, everybody talks about that being the key to acting. But if you get the right kid, a kid that doesn't tense up when people are around. Mm-hmm. And who's thoughtful enough to just kind of think about where they are, and then you tell them what to do in terms of you stand over here and then go over there. They just pull it off.
And then have mysterious light beams shoot out of your eyeballs.
Yeah, you know, are you going to do? He's such a sweet kid. That was actually the most difficult part, was just having him scream and yell. He was so polite, you know. He'd be like, no, you got to yell. You have to really yell. So we'd have to work him up into that.
I won't ask how. Okay. Magician shouldn't reveal all of his secrets.
True. You know, this is a total tangent. We don't have to get into it. But if you're interested, you should look at stories of how Spielberg directed kids. It's incredible. You realize just how smart that guy is, you know, in those scenes in Close Encounters. I'll tell an anecdote if you want.
Yeah, but please do.
This is all rumor I've heard. But so apparently, you know, there's scenes, I'll tell two, there's scenes where the boy's looking up at aliens in the sky. Mm-hmm. And Spielberg got on top of a ladder and got this beautifully wrapped present. And he just slowly started to unwrap this present. And you just see this kid's face looking at this present being unwrapped. There's also apparently a boom operator that the boy was really fond of, a big guy, and they always used to laugh and joke. So there's this amazing scene where the boy runs into the kitchen, and he sees something immediately that scares him, but then he smiles. And it's it's incredible, the range of emotion. I mean, this is like a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they had the boom operator put on a gorilla costume, and the kid runs around the corner and sees this gorilla and is scared. And then the guy takes off the head, and it's the funny guy that he liked, and he smiles. And I just thought that was genius.
It is genius.
It's just genius. Now, that's dealing with a three-year-old. You know, that's dealing with some kind of master puppetry almost to a degree.
Yes, exactly.
But very thoughtful execution.
Sure, sure. And not not cruel.
No.
Not invasive.
No. Because that's counterproductive.
Yeah.
You know, I always hear about these directors that yell and scream.
Yeah.
I just have never understood it. You know, these people are there to kill themselves for you, not just the actors, but the crew.
Sure.
And you want to inspire them. Mm-hmm. I've never understood about yelling at people. No. That makes sense.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And during that break, I'm going to give my guest permission to yell and scream as much as he wants. Something cathartic. I'm going to give you an opportunity for a mini catharsis moment here.
Thank you.
And our listeners too. Maybe you need it at home or where, if you're on your exercise bike or wherever you're listening to us. Feel free. Take a deep cleansing breath or scream and get it out. And we'll be back in just a minute. Iotic, featuring the best in original short form content, presents I Killed Susan Blake, a 4-part noir miniseries. One like you've never seen or heard before. The husband, the best friend, the sister, the gardener, the lover. They all had a reason to kill Susan Blake. Who didn't? When they all confess to Susan's murder, it's up to a grizzled detective to expose the shocking truth before one of them gets away with the ultimate crime. Hour by hour, their stories unfold. Lies come to light as the shocking truth behind Susan Blake's murder comes to a startling conclusion you will never forget. I Killed Susan Blake. They know who killed her. Do you? Check out I Killed Susan Blake online at Iotic TV. That's AIOTK.TV. Watch the first part for free, then get 11% off your Iotic subscription when you sign up for a year. You'll get exclusive access to everything on Iotic TV, including I Killed Susan Blake and the hit series Dudes. Iotic TV, today's voices, today's stories. And again, that's AITOK.TV. Welcome back to Maltin on Movies. I'm Leonard Maltin. My guest today is Jeff Nichols, who has graced us with several wonderful movies. I'm talking about Take Shelter and Mud, my favorite film of 2013, and my new favorite, my current favorite, Midnight Special, which is playing in theaters. And we were talking just briefly about the theatrical experience. And you know, there's so many convenient ways, so many almost irresistible ways to watch movies at home now. And especially if you're a parent or if you're a person who's busy.
Sure.
And during award season, you know, if you're in the industry and they send you these screeners, it's really hard to say, well, this is not Lawrence of Arabia. This is just a little documentary. And
right.
I could watch that here at home on my big TV and
sure.
not go a half hour car ride away, you know. To see this. And so sometimes I succumb, but it's always the last resort for me. It's always the last resort because there's nothing that can really equal that experience of being in a darkened theater with a simpatico audience, if you're lucky,
right?
With a screen that is larger than life and having that experience. And there's certain films that really not only invite that experience, but make the most of it. I would say that Midnight Special is one of those films.
Thank you.
Well, it casts a spell, it seems to me. That's that, and that spell is at its strongest in a movie theater environment.
You know, we talked about the process of watching this film, mm-hmm. the process of the storytelling. It's kind of nice when you can't hit pause. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to miss something. There's an immediacy there mm-hmm. that if you get up and leave, it's not stopping for you.
Yeah.
And I think that lines up very much with Midnight Special. It's mm-hmm. not going to stop for you.
Yeah.
And you need to sit there and watch it.
Yeah.
And so there's that benefit. Plus, pragmatically, we shoot in scope. You know, we shoot in 2.35, which mm-hmm. is larger than your, you know, rectangle TV. It's mm-hmm. it's a super rectangle. And it's a format that I love. It's a frame that I love.
Why?
Because it allows you to put things in the foreground and in the background. It allows you to have a truly sweeping wide shot. 1.85 is just not quite wide enough.
A CinemaScope frame is called 2.35:1, which means it's more than twice as wide as it is tall.
Correct.
And so that's a really, really wide screen.
It is, and they have wider. You know,
yeah.
I think 70 millimeter is wider. But, you know, I remember being in, it was fifth or sixth grade, and we had a beautiful dome theater in Little Rock, where I grew up. One screen, massive. It's where I saw Return of the Jedi. It's where I saw Indiana Jones. And they had a re-release of Lawrence of Arabia in scope. And even at that age, when I didn't know, you know, anything about the process of filmmaking, I knew that that was special. Now, and I think this is what Nolan's advocating, we have to make the experience special. You can't have ripped curtains and a blown out speaker and sticky floors. It just, it's not going to work, you know? I think we have to treat the movie going experience as something akin to what it really is, which is a special experience.
Well, couldn't agree more. And I know that our listeners are real film buffs and film lovers. And I hope they share that feeling and that they express it by going to see your movie.
Please do, you know. And if you can't, look, I get it. I have a kid. At least just do one thing for me. If you're going to watch this movie at home on your brand new $1,500 TV you just got from Best Buy, please turn off those settings that make it look like a bad soap opera. Like there's a progressive frame rate setting inside your television. Go into the menu and turn it off. That's the best thing you can do for me if you're going to watch this movie at home.
It'll look more like film.
Absolutely.
And less like, as you say, a shiny video.
Yeah, it's terrible.
But you mentioned some films that you've seen and liked and even emulated. One of the things we like to do on this podcast is ask our guests if there are films that they particularly like that they think are kind of unsung or underrated that you would recommend to people.
Well, go back and watch Starman. It's not going to hold up for everybody, but there's a lot of beauty in it. You know, I think Carpenter obviously takes short shrift to Spielberg a lot of times, but I think that's a film that's really beautifully crafted and beautifully acted.
Oh, Jeff Bridges in that film.
He's great, you know, he's great. And what a performance that could have gone off the rails, you know, but didn't. And I think that's Bridges for you.
I think he got an Oscar nomination for that, in fact.
And
that's what I remember. As soon as you say that, that's what I remember. I remember that, was it a birthing scene kind of?
Yeah.
That's what I take with me in my mind.
It's a very nicely made film. It's a smartly made film. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in honor of Midnight Special, that's the one I would tell people to go back and see.
What are other films that have influenced you? You think in a long lasting way?
I have a go to list. Mm-hmm. You know, Badlands is a film I encountered first in college, and that seems to be, you know, inspirational for pretty much any young middle class white guy filmmaker working today. I like to think I don't rip it off as much as some other people, but maybe I do. You know, that was just the first time I was ever confronted with a new narrative format in filmmaking. I saw it in college and was just kind of just blown away by it. But I also, I'm a big fan of Paul Newman. Pretty much.
Shows excellent taste.
Well, thank you. again, you know, everybody talks about Brando, but Newman's the one I gravitate toward, maybe because of the films themselves. But I also think there's something in his performances that he's inherently likable but adds layers and depth. If you look at The Hustler, if you look at HUD, Cool Hand Luke, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, these are films that are all you'll always find in my top 10. Mm-hmm. Building out from there, you got to throw some Hitchcock in there. North by Northwest is my favorite. I love the mystery in that film and the way it unfolds, and I also love the pragmatism in it.
What do you mean?
It seems like, you know, Cary Grant's in that film just dealing with this really bizarre situation. He almost seems, you know, he's not freaking out. In those first scenes when he goes to that mansion, he's kind of just – he's joking around with this guy because it's so absurd to him.
Yeah.
And at first you watch that and think, well, that's – you need to be really scared. These people have just kidnapped you. But he thinks it's so absurd. He thinks it's mistaken identity that he doesn't behave that way. Mm-hmm. So the behavior is actually quite in line with kind of a pragmatic response.
This is the man who has rot on his monogrammed handkerchiefs.
So, yes, exactly.
Anything's possible.
But, you have to throw some Spielberg in there. You know, mm-hmm. I think Jaws is a masterfully crafted film. You think about the scene at the kitchen table when the young boy is mirroring his father's, you know, facial expressions. Mm-hmm. Incredible scene to have in a Hollywood blockbuster, you know, about a giant killer shark. Mm-hmm. Also Close Encounters, again, mm-hmm. in honor of Midnight Special, mostly. I'm a big fan of Fletch, this Michael Ritchie film with Chevy Chase. Mm-hmm. I usually include that one on the list just to make people know that I'm not a snob. it's not just about cinephile stuff. These are movies that I've just seen a million times. Mm-hmm. You know, in college, we had a TV with a DVD player and no cable, and we had two DVDs. We had Goodfellas and we had Fletch. And I've seen those two films so
really,
many times.
You really know Fletch.
Oh, I know it. We can go into a quote fest anytime you want.
But we won't bother with Fletch Lives. We'll just stick with Fletch.
Yeah, that one, if we'd had that DVD, maybe. But no. It was mainly just Fletch. But
And Michael Ritchie is an underrated
director. He's an absolutely underrated director. In fact, he did a film, and I always get the title wrong, with Holly Hunter, that I think was made for TV, The Incredibly True Confessions of a Teenage mm-hmm, Murderer, mm-hmm. Cheerleader Murdering Mom. Mm-hmm. Incredible. That has a Bridges in it, mm-hmm. And it's that's a phenomenal film that not many people know about. You'd have to Google the title because I just butchered it.
Yeah. Which I won't do while we're sitting here because that would be not only rude but a cheat.
Yes.
It would be a cheat, an outright cheat. But not everything Michael Ritchie touched turned to gold, but he has a very high batting average. And
he was just a smart guy, you know. I'm going to make a bad movie. It's destined, it's kind of like musical chairs, you know. Mm-hmm. You just wonder when are you going to sit in the bad one, and it's because making films is an alchemy, you know. It really is. There are too many variables to get it right every single time, but you try to just be as honest as you can and do it and try and be a conscious mind out there working in the universe. And I think Ritchie struck me as that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The I saw. In the late 80s at the Telluride Film Festival, they did a panel about even then they did a panel about the sort of the golden age of the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he was on that panel with Saul Zantz and Peter Bogdanovich and a lot of other people who were, you know, major players in that period, which some people called the silver age of Hollywood.
Right.
And I remember Michael Ritchie being asked what he thought was the biggest difference between the early 70s. When he and a lot of other people had a chance to blossom, and the late 80s. And he said two words, middle management. But in the early 70s, there was not yet what we know now as the independent film sphere, the world of independent filmmaking. Most of his films, like most of the others that were made there, were made for studios.
Yes.
It was studios who were backing and producing these movies, even Easy Rider.
Yeah.
You know, which is sort of the poster child for the revolution in American filmmaking. He said, and now you have to go through layers and layers and layers of people. But then you pitched it to one guy who could say yes or no.
Yes.
The head of production of the studio. That was it. If they said yes, you got to make the film. And they kind of left you alone.
It's very much what happened with Midnight Special.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I walked in the door with the script with Mike Shannon and mm-hmm. myself. And my history of movies and said, hey, I love you guys. Do you guys love me? and fortunately, they said yes. You know, I think – I don't know what Ritchie was specifically talking about with middle management, but I know development, you know, that's the standard operating procedure now. They say, well, okay, we're going to get your idea and you do a draft and then we're going to give you notes and then you do another draft and we're going to give you notes and then you can do another draft and then we're going to fire you and hire somebody else to not look at your script and rewrite it just from the idea. And then maybe we'll be getting someplace. I'm sure some really fine films have been made that way,
mm-hmm.
not mine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a process that I really seek out, you know. I think there needs to be a strong voice behind these films because, again, it's an alchemy. And in order to get through the gauntlet that is the filmmaking process, you need somebody who's willing to stand in front of a firing squad and say, this is what I think the film's about, you know, and take the credit and take the knocks.
Well, I think in this case you're going to get mostly credit. Hmm. I think you'll be on the positive side of that equation. Some. And thank you again for coming today and for joining in. Thanks, it's always fun talking movies with a movie lover, which you clearly are, as well as a movie maker. And that may sound obvious. I guess most filmmakers are movie lovers, but
maybe. But I don't consider myself a cinephile. You know?
Yeah,
I don't have. You hear about Wes Anderson having an encyclopedic knowledge. Mm-hmm. I don't. I know my movies that I like, you know, and I can talk about those.
Yeah, but that's all you need. I mean,
yeah.
But you have love though.
I do. I love movies,
and that's
I love them.
I think that's the prime requirement.
Well, thank you. I like talking to you about them.
Thanks for tuning in today, and we're very lucky to have people like Jeff on our guest list, and we'll have more surprises in store if you come back next week and the week after that and the week after that. And thank you for your support, for spreading the word about our show. I am Leonard Maltin. You can find me on Twitter at Leonard Maltin. You can find me online almost anytime at leonardmaltin.com. And thanks again. See you soon. Today's episode was sponsored by the good folks at Iotic. Iotic brings you the best in original short-form content from today's voices telling today's stories. Be sure to check out I Killed Susan Blake exclusively on Iotic TV. That's AITOK.TV. Don't forget to sign up for your 11%. That's an 11% discount on your first year subscription. Find them on the web today at AIOTKIotic.TV.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at, like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-334-KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.